Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Sherlock Holmes, deducing as chewing factoids, chasing down the fact wherever it leads. Sometimes it may lead nowhere. The fact cannot be verified. It is accurate and therefore is not usable. Our guest actually is Kim Oleski, author of All Facts Considered, The Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. She is a noted NPR librarian, and the book is a collection of fascinating facts on, you name it, it goes everywhere, history, science to the arts. She is NPR's longest-serving librarian, a member of the team that provides fact-checking, background research, and grammar and pronunciation guides to NPR's radio programs and digital media projects. She is married to the man who was senior producer of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday for a number of years, Robert Maleski. She's produced election night briefing books, has documented the early history of the network, and in her spare time, she collects books and New York City memorabilia, enjoys European travel, and she must have the best of these anywhere. She works on her family genealogy. We are going to welcome phone calls for Key, and we'll go through a number of the very interesting facts that are in the book. I found myself writing a lot of them down, so I got to make sure I got all my papers and page numbers in front of me. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Key, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, great to have you here. I would think that being an NPR librarian and being a talk show host are somewhat similar in that we have all kinds of little bits of knowledge about many, many topics. We really are generalists, but we're very curious about things. But I'm not sure.
Exactly.
Is that true?
Oh, I think that's an obvious similarity. You have to be interested in any topic that might come up at any time, or I guess at least be able to fake an interest. In the case of the librarians, figure out how to look up the subject.
Yeah, listen, if you can fake sincerity, you got it made in life, isn't that true?
Isn't it?
So you were the kid who in fifth grade had her hand up all the time, even though you may not have known the answer. There you were with your hand up.
You know, I like to know things, and I like to share what I know.
So your career was pretty much etched when you were in fifth grade.
Well, I didn't realize it myself. I did some other things in my 20s and then got a job at NPR and was doing administrative work in the cultural department. And I got to work on some wonderful projects, but the work itself wasn't really satisfying. And so I left and got my master's degree in library science and didn't expect to come back to NPR as a librarian, but it just worked out that way. And so my whole library career has been here at NPR, first cataloging programs and then for about 23 years now, answering questions for reporters, producers, hosts.
That's a long time.
It's a lot of fun, though.
Yeah, I bet it is. You talk about your brain being stuffed with zillions of facts after all of those years. Is it true? Is this true that you wake up sometimes at 4 in the morning and have questions about how many states have had two Senate elections in the same year?
Know.
Do you really?
I do. In the middle of the night, old reference question will come to mind, or you know, something like that I've been reading recently that you know, kind of percolates up there, and I want to know the answer.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say that you always turn to an expert because there's always somebody out there whose job it is to know the thing that you need. That you look at books, obviously,
exactly.
And on the web, but you call people.
Oh, of course. I mean, that was one of the first things I learned in a news library. As you say, it's somebody's job to know the fact that I'm looking for. Someone is paying attention to that every day. So in addition to perhaps looking at academic articles or news and magazine pieces, I very often recommend to the journalist that he or she talk directly to an expert. And that could be an academic or an association of some kind, someone in a government agency. But you know, as I say, that somebody who pays attention to this fact every day and is going to give you the most up-to-date and complete picture.
Mm-hmm. And so tell me about the people who are asking you questions. Is it your talk hosts or is it news people? Are you doing election
It's
historical material, everything.
Everything. All of the NPR programs, so the news magazines, the talk show, anything like that, and also anything on NPR.org. So people who were putting together election material for the webpage would have consulted us, and we were also putting together material for the reporters in the field to use as they covered the races. And corporate NPR, not a primary client of us, of course. We spend most of our time with the journalists, but we will answer questions for the other departments in NPR as needed, other than, of course, the legal research. We don't do that.
Right.
We leave that to the professionals.
Where do you go for pronunciation?
Well, there's not one good single source. We do have specific dictionaries that NPR has selected to be our authorities, and so we use those for common English terms. The real difficulties come when we're dealing with foreign names and places. And so we might call an embassy or try to get in touch with a person directly. But we like to pronounce a name the way the person who owns that name prefers to have it pronounced. And as much as is reasonable, the names of cities and countries, the way the people who live there pronounce them. But of course, there are sounds that are difficult, if not impossible, for Americans to pronounce. And there are things that are not comfortable to the American ear. We're used to hearing a certain pronunciation, and even if it isn't the way the residents say it, it's what Americans are used to, and so we stay with that. So that means, as I say, it's very difficult to have any rules or any one source and just feel comfortable with them. So we use a number of print and online sources and make phone calls when necessary.
Hmm. I know there are, and I'm wondering how many of these there are at NPR, but I immediately think of France, and when reporters are giving us stories from France, mm-hmm. that you can tell they all speak French. And mm-hmm. I find myself, I'd be driving in the car, and it'll roll off their tongue, and it sounds so beautiful. And then mm-hmm. I try to say it, too, because it sounds great. Is that something that you look for in reporters, if they can speak the language, all the better?
Well, I'm sure, and certainly when the foreign desk is hiring reporters or contracting with freelancers in some of these places, they're very likely already to know the language, or they would take some classes. So I believe not too long ago we had a reassignment, and David Green went to Moscow, and he did spend a couple of months before he had to be on the air regularly learning the language and settling in and meeting people and sources, yeah.
Yeah, which is the way it should be everywhere. I'll bet it's not these days, but it should be that way. Now, you got to tell me before we go to what's in the book about your family genealogy. You must have the best one in the country, don't you? Considering
I don't think so.
You don't?
Because it's not just about your ability to search and your willingness to put in the time. It's what records are available. And, you know, I'm descended from a couple of Irish soldiers around the time of the U.S. Civil War.
Oh.
And only because they were in the military did they leave behind any kind of records. One of them died young. The other spent his whole career in the Army. Neither of them ever owned property or left a will or an estate or anything like that that I could track. And so it's government records, census records, and military records. But living here in Washington, D.C., as I have for the last 40 years, I had, before these things went online, I had easy access to the National Archives and to go through those kinds of records that now I can do right from my computer at home. But there's still many gaps, as I'm sure most of us trying to fill in our genealogy discover there are things that we just can't find out.
Right. There is a section in the book that deals with how many people came through Ellis Island, one of the mm-hmm. facts, which is really fascinating.
Right.
Huge numbers of people.
That's
and then
right.
it stopped for a while. But it was amazing how the America welcomed, I think it was 11,000, one of your figures, just in one day.
On one single day.
Isn't
yeah,
that something?
High point. Yes.
Woo.
Yes. Yeah. Now, most of my family was already here before Ellis Island opened up. So I don't have any. I have one relative who went through Ellis Island, and that's all.
Hmm. Well, you make me. That's something that I was supposed to be in charge of for the family for years and years, and I've just neglected my duty. So maybe you will inspire me. So with all of these facts, zillions of facts in your head, you're doing this back, the book of all facts considered, and it's interesting. It's sort of like an NPR book in a way because you've got history and you've got music and you've got, you know, geography and people and languages and religion, and it's the kind of thing that NPR does.
Exactly. That's what appealed to me about the idea, was that I could cover as many different areas as I could think of. And so, of course, the book does not contain all facts, but I tried to consider all facts, or at least to make an attempt to cover the range of human history and experience and science and inventions and literature and art and things that I thought other people would find interesting.
It's a big task, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it?
Whoa! It's a really big task. So let's go to Earth, page 39. I'll let you know what things I've written down.
Sure.
The Earth. I don't think most of us know how old the Earth is.
Maybe our listeners do. This one Planet Earth 101 because it was just the basics. And the most recent scientific estimation is that the planet is 4.6 billion years old.
Huh.
That's pretty old.
That is pretty old, isn't it?
Yeah.
How about, let's go to, well, we're just going to hop all over the place because the book does. We speak to you, though, from the Great Lakes. We're right, I'm about a couple blocks away from Lake Michigan here. And
one
that
of
is
my favorite facts. This is a real question.
Okay.
Some years ago, at the time, reporter Alex Chadwick called up and asked me this question. How much water is in the entire Great Lakes system?
Hey.
And I thought, hey, that's an interesting question. So this was long enough ago that my first choice wasn't the computer. We had lots of reference books on the shelf at that point, and I went to several of them and looked up the Great Lakes. And if they said anything about the volume of water, the numbers from one source to another seemed to be quite different. And so I was concerned, well, which one do I choose? So, again, I remembered the basic rule, turn to an expert, that there must be someone paying attention to the Great Lakes. And there is the Great Lakes Historical Society. And I called them up and I asked the question, how much water is in the entire system? And the answer is 6.025 quadrillion gallons.
Wow.
And that, of course, you know, the Great Lakes are the largest group of freshwater lakes in the world, and they contain 18% of the planet's fresh surface water. Only the polar ice caps have more. And when I was researching this fact again before putting it in the book to make sure that, you know, I still had the details correct, and now, of course, it's on the web. I didn't have to phone them. I emailed. But I like the fact that the Great Lakes Historical Society's website is called inlandseas.org.
I like
that
too.
Because that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. So, Key, when you put in your mind, because I can't put this in my mind, how much is 6.025 quadrillion? What do you think of when you think of a quadrillion?
We haven't gotten to that yet in the national debt, I'm happy to say, but
you we know, might.
We could. Million, billion, trillion, quadrillion is next. So I forget offhand exactly how many zeros that is.
How often are you?
Lot.
It is a lot. How often are you asked for historical information?
Oh, pretty frequently. You know, as context for a story, people might want to know, how was this handled, you know, 100 years ago or 50 years ago, or what's the last time something like this happened? So we do spend a good bit of time looking in encyclopedias and older reference books and, you know, finding good websites that contain historic information, because those do come up pretty often.
Yeah, I love all the information about the presidents, and I found it interesting because you wouldn't have thought this. I can't remember what page it's on, but the number of presidents, former presidents who were alive, there were as many as five presidents alive.
That's right. I think there were 3 points in U.S. history.
There you go.
Where there were five former presidents alive at the same time. Let me see if I can find that, because I didn't memorize all of the
I'm sure you didn't.
The details. And I don't want to paraphrase something and get it wrong, because then a caller will.
Yeah, well, we can find it. We can find it at some point, too.
I know where it is. Okay.
Oh, you got it?
I think I do. Yes. Okay. In 1861, when Abraham Lincoln was inaugurated, there were five presidents living: Martin Van Buren, John Tyler, Millard Fillmore, Franklin Pierce, and James Buchanan. Then in 1993, when Clinton was inaugurated, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, and George H.W. Bush were all alive. And in 2001, when George W. Bush was inaugurated, Ford, Carter, Reagan, his father, Bush the First, and Clinton were all alive. So we had those three moments where we had, as I called it, plenty of presidents.
Yeah. Where is the—I got to find this. We'll pause for a second. Let's go to the religion section in a moment, because okay. You have some statistics that— that are contrary than what most people think. How many people are Christian, Buddhist, Hindu? How many people don't believe in things? Mm-hmm. How many are pagans? So we'll go to that in just a moment. And we'll welcome phone calls as well. Kee Molesky is our guest this hour. She is the author, All Facts Considered, The Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. Scott Simon has said that she is the source of all human knowledge. She is the NPR's longest-serving librarian, a member of the team that provides a lot of things: fact-checking, background research, grammar and pronunciation guides to NPR's radio programs and digital media projects. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and the email is talk@wpr.org. Page 74, the numbers of the faithful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I found an internet initiative called adherence.com, which is not affiliated with any religious, political, or educational organization, but has made some attempt to put numbers to the various religious denominations around the world. And according to them, there are 2.1 billion Christians, 1.5 billion members of the Islamic sects, 900 million Hindus, 394 million people practicing Chinese traditional religion, 376 million Buddhists, 300 million people who are members of primal, indigenous, and animist denominations, and an additional 1.1 billion people who describe themselves as secular, non-religious, agnostic, or atheist.
That's something. I would have had no idea that number was almost as large as the number of people who consider themselves to be Muslims.
Yes.
That's a lot of people, isn't it?
It is large,
yeah.
Yes.
Some of the numbers are interesting. On the same page, 75, the lucky number 7. In many cultures and religions, it is a significant number. Why?
Well, that turned out to be kind of difficult to nail down. It's just an assumption that and a fact that over the centuries, many different cultures have looked upon 7 as significant and lucky. And I found one researcher who explains it this way: 7 is an odd and arbitrary number with a long numerological and mystical literature celebrating the supposed magic of 7. It is the perfect number, according to Pythagoras, the sum of 3, the triangle, plus 4, the square, which are both lucky too. And then in researching it further, I discovered that the wedding planner website, theknot.com, calculated that on July 7th, 2007, 777, tens of thousands of American couples chose to be married that day because they considered it especially auspicious. And I believe the same thing happened this year with 10-10-10.
Interesting.
That many, many more than on a normal weekend, many more weddings because of the auspiciousness of those numbers.
9 for Hindus, great significance in Hinduism, the oldest living religion on earth, page 68.
Okay. The number 9 is of great significance in Hinduism, the oldest living religion. 9 is closely associated with the process of creation in the cosmic time cycle. Hindus have 9 beliefs that summarize their spirituality. 1, all-pervasive supreme being, the divinity of the Vedic scriptures, the endless cycles of creation, karma, the law of cause and effect, the reincarnation of the soul, personal rituals that create connections with unseen worlds, personal discipline and an enlightened guide as essentials, the sacredness of all life, and the idea that all paths to God deserve tolerance and understanding.
Let's go to some phone calls. We'll go to the Ten Commandments at some point here.
Okay.
I had no idea there were so many versions of the Ten Commandments. Let's go first to Jeff from Spring Green. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is if your guest has ever researched the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, or something in Europe called the Round Table. And my other question is why I never hear anything about these groups on NPR or Wisconsin Public Radio, since they are at least the Council on Foreign Relations is where key posts in government come from.
Have you researched that?
Well, not research about those organizations. There are times that we use the council or some of the scholars associated with the council as sources, and I know that they've been interviewed on NPR. I don't think any of those organizations have been the subject of stories, and I don't think we've had any questions. Nothing comes to mind to do research into the history or the background of those groups.
Yeah. Judy is next from Custer. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Kathleen. Here's a question that has driven my husband and me nuts for quite a while, and that is we hear these different pronunciations of Carnegie and Carnegie,
okay.
And then Caribbean and Caribbean.
Okay. The first one actually is in my book, the Carnegie. I tell the story of how Carnegie Hall came to be built in New York. And
yes.
So, of course, I had to put in both pronouncers because the hall does indeed call itself Carnegie, and that's
yes.
their choice. But Mr. Andrew Carnegie, who donated the money and money for many public libraries across the country, did pronounce his name Carnegie, which my understanding is that's the standard pronunciation in Scotland, which is where he was from.
Okay, good.
So that's why, in that case, really, neither side is wrong. And the university, I believe, is Carnegie Mellon, because that's from the family as well. And I'm sorry, what was the other one? Oh, Caribbean and Caribbean. My understanding there is that throughout the region, there is not universal one or the other. And so NPR has not selected one over the other. There are a number of people who work here at NPR who are from the Caribbean, and I've checked with all of them, and they indeed say that from country to country the both pronunciations do exist.
We hear some people saying one way and some the other. I see.
Right. So again, neither side is really wrong on that case.
Do you feel a whole lot better, Judy?
Much.
Oh, good.
I'll check
good.
With my husband.
Thank you for caring about proper pronunciation.
Oh, really. People who listen to public radio are sticklers, aren't they?
Even when we're right, they can get upset.
Exactly. And I had a case in point because I was mispronouncing, I think, for years. And then I realized what the correct pronunciation is. And I always went back to the other one was Pulitzer.
Oh, yes.
Or Pulitzer.
That's the same thing. There are members of the family who say Pulitzer.
Oh, there
the
are.
Prize. Yes.
Oh.
And I'm not sure Joseph Pulitzer himself, I never heard a recording of him saying his own name, so I can't say. But the prize is Pulitzer.
Pulitzer, right.
Excellent.
What about Appalachia?
Appalachia is what's used throughout the region. My understanding from a reporter who was there recently is there's a small corner of Ohio, which most people don't even realize is part of the Appalachian region, and they say it that way. But for the most part, throughout the region, it is Appalachia.
Hmm.
So NPR tries to encourage people to use that pronunciation.
Mm-hmm. So the same would be true of Missouri or Missouri?
Yes, and actually Scott Simon did an interview not too long ago about that, and so I was asked to research it, and very strong feeling within the state on both sides as to which is right, and so we certainly weren't able to come up with a definitive answer. Both are certainly in use.
And
the two sides fight about it constantly, apparently.
Can you say who uses the library the most? Is it Scott Simon?
No, actually, our primary users are the reporters. And so usually we do keep statistics. Usually the national desk is number one. So that's all the reporters here in Washington and out in the field. And that's I'm not even sure the number, but of course, there are dozens of reporters around the U.S. and here in Washington covering the country. So the national desk overall is our number one customer.
Tell us the story. I was listening to you when you were on with him the week before this week, I think. And you told this really, and I miss him so much, this interesting Daniel Schorr story.
The fact that's in the book? That
yes.
Yes, okay. Dan Schorr called me, and this was some years ago, I think in the late 90s. And he called and said he needed to know where in the book, All the President's Men, the phrase "follow the money" appeared. So we happened to have a copy of the book on the shelf, so I was able to take a look at it right away. And the book, as in any good nonfiction book, has an index. And the phrase would have been uttered by their main source, who was known as Deep Throat until a few years ago when we found out it was Mark Felt.
Right.
So I looked in the index for all of the entries for Deep Throat, and I checked them. And in none of them was he saying, "follow the money." So my policy for Dan Schorr always was to do anything, go any length to make sure he got the information he needed. So I paged through the book, every page, looking for the phrase. I didn't find it. I did a search of newspaper articles, the phrase "follow the money" near the phrase "all the president's men." And I found lots of stories, but all the references were to the film. None of the references were to the book. So I went to Dan and explained all that. So he said, "I'm going to call Bob Woodward and ask him." And he did, and he said, where in the book does it appear? And Mr. Woodward said, "Well, I can't recall. Let me take a look, and I'll get back to you." And while Dan was waiting to hear from him, he came back to me and told me about the conversation and said, "But I don't want to wait." So he said, "Who wrote the screenplay? Wasn't it William Goldman?" And I said, "Yes, it was." And he said, "I know William Goldman. I'm going to call him." And so in talking to William Goldman, Dan discovered, or Mr. Goldman realized, they had kind of made up the phrase in talking about the book and turning it into a screenplay. And so it was never actually said in the story of Watergate. And so I called that fact, "He should have said it."
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it also shows you the kind of reporter that Daniel Schorr was, too, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
It?
Yes. Dogged. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah.
That
I'm gonna
he
get
would
the
not
truth
give
here.
Up.
Right.
Exactly.
That's quite a story.
Yeah.
Dave is next from West Salem. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hello.
See, I have a question. I had recently been trying to help my nephew study for a history test and American Revolution, and I was trying to show him or talk to him about how sometimes things are like common knowledge, but they really didn't happen. And I said, "Well, you know, I'd read that Betsy Ross, the only reason that Betsy Ross is known is that her family in 1876 wanted to make some money or something for the centennial. So they made this story up about her participating in making the flag." And he goes, "Well, that's funny, because in my history book it says that she participated with Washington, and she showed me this, and I felt kind of foolish." And I just wondered, I know the American, I think it's People's History of the United States says she didn't. Do you happen to know?
I don't offhand know what the absolute latest scholarly thinking is. I've seen stories along the lines of what you've just described. I've also seen that I think there's no doubt there was such a person, and she probably did make a flag. Whether she made the first flag is probably the question. And so perhaps that's where her family was embellishing the details a little bit.
So where would you go to find the answer?
Well, I would look for, I would probably do some searching in academic journals and try to get a sense of what the current thinking is, because historians are always finding new records or reanalyzing old material or, you know, putting together, connecting the dots and coming up with a new theory. So I would probably try to figure out who's the number one expert on Betsy Ross and get in touch with that person.
Hmm.
So I have a similar story in the book, which is, did George Washington chop down the cherry tree?
Yes, right.
And that's something that was believed to be an absolute fact for many, many decades, and then was debunked by historians, but still to today is repeated as if it were true or probably true, and and it's probably not even close to being true. It's probably absurd.
But we like to think of him that way, don't we?
Well, you know, and that, as people say, never let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, Dave?
Thank you.
You know where to go to do some research now, huh?
Yeah, right. I appreciate it.
All right. Hey, let's go back now to the Ten. Let's go to the Ten Commandments, page 69.
Oh, okay.
There are lots of versions of the Ten Commandments.
Well, that I won't read all of them now.
No,
but
it's several pages.
What I say in the intro to the fact is, when people discuss placing the Ten Commandments in public spaces, I always wonder, what version do they plan to use? Because Judaism, the early Catholic and Christian Church, and the current Christian denominations have some variations in the numbering and the language. So, you know, your seventh commandment might be my eighth or something like that. So in terms of the First Amendment and the question of religion and of posting something like the Ten Commandments in a public place, I think that's part of the issue, is what version are you going to use? And as you say, most people weren't even aware that there is more than one version.
So what version, what is most commonly used?
Well, I absolutely don't know. I would have to check, you know, every courtroom that has them displayed or every state house and check the wording and the numbering and figure out whether they use you could consider the Protestant version that most Protestant denominations follow, the version that Catholics and some Lutherans follow, or the version that Jewish people prefer. Mm.
Here's an email from Shirley. She's interested in your work on tracing your family tree. Mm-hmm. Can you recommend any sources to search family genealogy? I'm particularly interested in something to use for Scotland.
I'm not expert on outside of the U.S. sources, but there are certainly groups. I belong to an Irish genealogical society. I'm sure there would be one for Scotland and for Scottish Americans as well. And so I would try to find them. There's now a commercial database service called Ancestry.com mm-hmm. that has absolutely made it so much easier than what we used to have to do. And, of course, you had to be in Washington and get to the National Archives or be in some place where the Church of Latter-day Saints has libraries where they've done genealogical research that's available to the public. And so this makes it incredibly easy. And they've got census records and marriage and divorce and death and birth records from many, many parts of the U.S. But as I say, I'm not at all an expert in overseas what records are available and how you get at them, but I'm sure you could find an association in the U.S. that could help you.
Right. Let's go next to Joe from Harper's Ferry, Iowa. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Say, I'm curious, if you could gather six people from history, say, and have a roundtable discussion, who would you choose? Would it be Aristotle, Einstein, Johnny Carson? I'm curious what you would have.
That's a good beginning.
Yes, it is.
That's a really difficult question because, of course, there are dozens and dozens of interesting characters in history. But I think, yes, maybe an ancient philosopher and then perhaps someone, from the Middle Ages or the period of Enlightenment, Francis Bacon or Isaac Newton, having a conversation with Johnny Carson. I would want to at least be listening in there, if not participating. Abraham Lincoln,
yes.
President, John Kennedy, just looking at American presidents. You can go on and on. I know lots of people like to kind of play this party game. And, if you could have dinner with 5 or 6 or 10, but I'd have an awful difficult time limiting it to just 6 people, I think.
That's because you have too many facts in your head.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Where do I stop?
Yeah, right. There's just too much there. Thanks, Joe, for the call. David is next from Rock Springs. Hi, David.
Hi. I have a question about the Arkansas River, which starts in Colorado. And when on the way to the Missouri River, it's called Arkansas. In most places except for Kansas, where it's called Arkansas River. And just wondered about the origins. I suspect it's a regional cultural thing, but the difference in the pronunciation between Kansas and Arkansas, and what mm-hmm. what the addition of the syllable or the prefix R would stand for, signify.
Mm-hmm. I'm really not sure. I think both of those are derived originally from Native American terms. And, of course, there's lots of those place names all over the U.S., and most of them are corruptions of what the original word would have been and just approximations of the original pronunciation. That one, that's not come up. No one's ever asked me about the difference between Arkansas and Arkansas, although I am aware that that there is that difference.
Hmm. The Native American tribe, I know that they're referred to as the Kaw, K-A-W. In fact, some people call, I think, the Kansas River in Wichita the Kaw. So that's another curious maybe corruption of the name.
Sounds that way.
Hmm. Thank you, David. Thanks for the call. All right, let's get some interesting things that we use every day, or many of us do, and we don't even think about. Page 56. Thousand Island salad dressing.
Ah, okay. This one was fun. Well, this one came up. We were sitting here at NPR after weekend Saturday having our lunch, and the question of the salad dressing came up. Thousand Island salad dressing. So I did the research, and here's the story. It is actually named for a thousand islands. More precisely, 1,864 islands in the St. Lawrence River between the United States and Canada. According to the Thousand Islands Tourism Bureau, quote, to become an official part of the count, an island must meet two criteria. It must be above water 365 days a year, and it must support two living trees. For the past century, two hotels in the towns of Clayton and Alexandria Bay, New York, have been fighting, good-naturedly, I'm sure, over the right to claim that they originated the mayonnaise-based condiment.
Huh. Amazing what comes up over your lunchtime conversation, isn't it?
Yeah, and my colleagues wanted to go up there and plant more trees on the so that more of them would qualify as.
It's great. The number of books, page 24, the number of books in the Library of Congress. Oh, my gosh, it's unbelievable.
Yes, they have quite a large number of items. Let's see. It is the largest library in the world, with about 145 million items on approximately 745 miles of bookshelves. So that collection is 33 million books and other print materials, 3 million recordings, 12.5 million photographs, 5.3 million maps, 6 million pieces of sheet music, and 63 million manuscripts.
Unbelievable.
And every day they're adding 10,000 more items, so I'm going to have to update those numbers soon.
Yeah. And yet, at NPR, I think I read in the book that you only have about 200 books. Is that right? Are they all reference books?
Well, we used to have a much larger book collection. We would qualify as kind of a medium-sized news library. We had about 3,000 books on the shelves. And most of that material now is available electronically. And that means more than one person can be using it at a time. It can be available to any NPR staffer anywhere in the world, anytime. And just obviously much more flexible and efficient. And so, yes, we have a much smaller collection of books now. Things that particular patrons really prefer to use, the print version, or things that are not available electronically, or just a basic collection so that if the computers are down or the power grid is having difficulty, we can still function in the library.
And you have been able, as a librarian, see, I have not been able to make that transition. I have to have my books around me at my house and at my office, too, just to know they're there. And there's the fact in the book, if I need it, I know I have it. But you have made the transition.
Well, I certainly have professionally, because it wasn't an option not to. I mean, that's just the reality of the news library world. But at home, I still have lots and lots of books, piles of books everywhere, a whole room that is just our library and office. And so I'm kind of, it's interesting to be in this time of transition. And I guess eventually there'll be very, very few things done on paper. But for now, I'm happy to have both options.
Thanks, David, for the call. Keith in Appleton, hi.
Oh, hi. This is just a question along the lines of American musical history. Who got to decide on our national anthem? And is there still a scuttlebutt about maybe we should change it to God Bless America or America the Beautiful and so forth? That's about
well,
it.
Well, I know those suggestions do come up occasionally, if only because those others are easier to sing than the Star-Spangled Banner. Of course, we know it was written by Francis Scott Key in 1814, but I'm not sure the details. It wasn't officially made the national anthem until much later, I think in the 20th century, right? But I don't know offhand the details of what the discussion was at the time, whether they were considering others or exactly how the process went for recognizing it to be the national anthem.
I wonder how you would change it, because I'm with him. I think America the Beautiful is a much easier
That's
to sing,
lovely,
and it's a beautiful song.
Yes,
too.
Yes.
So I think we should change it. If I wanted to do that.
I assume then that would have to be by act of Congress.
Would
so
it?
You could begin with your local representatives. And I'm not aware if anything like that has happened lately. I mean, I have heard, I've certainly seen people writing to newspapers and talking about it online and making that suggestion. But I don't know whether it's been considered by Congress anytime recently.
I sense part of a talk show.
For my next book.
Maybe it would be.
Yeah.
And while we're thinking about music, this is just astounding to me. Page 59, what goes into a Steinway grand piano?
Oh, yes.
Woo!
Yeah. A lot of effort.
A lot of effort.
A concert grand piano is one of the more complex devices built by human hands. Steinway pianos, still entirely handmade, have about 12,000 individual parts. To make one instrument in the company's Long Island City, New York factory takes nearly a year and about 450 skilled artisans, case makers, plate fitters, grand finishers, belly makers, stringers, fine tuners, among many others.
Isn't that a work of art?
Amazing, yeah. Exactly, it is. Besides being a beautiful instrument, they are just absolutely beautiful things to look at.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Kim Oleski is our guest. She is the author of All Facts Considered, the Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. She's a noted NPR librarian, and she does all kinds of work. She does background research for the many news reporters, talk show hosts. She does pronunciation guides for the programs, digital media projects. And we're welcoming phone calls for her on this book, which is All Facts Considered, the Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email that's come in, Key, a question about your name from Jackie in Green Bay. I've always wondered about Key's first name when hearing references to NPR's librarian. Until today, I didn't know if it was a male or a female. Is Key a given name or a nickname?
It's a nickname. My name's Christine. And when I was growing up, my baby sister had some trouble saying that. And she came up with Key, and I thought it was a pretty cool name. So I stuck with it.
It's been cool your whole life, huh?
That's right.
Yeah, it is a cool name. Key.
It is.
Yeah. Karen is next from Green Bay. Hi, Karen.
Hi there. I just have a question on how to pronounce homogenous. Is it homogenous or homogeneous? I heard two guests recently say the latter, and I'm just wondering how to say it.
I'm pretty sure that homogenous
is the right way.
Is correct. But it may be a little bit more complicated than that. And it's not one I put in the book, so I don't have it in front of me. But there are lots of words where at NPR, anyway, we don't feel there has to be a standard envelope, envelope, either.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it doesn't confuse the listener. As long as it's still clear what you're talking about, then, you know, we're okay with personal and certainly regional variations. People do have accents in this country, and you can't tell someone that they're wrong because they've got a regional accent. But I'm not sure the details on homogeneous or homogeneous. But you're right. You certainly do hear both pronunciations. Hmm. So I would have to look into that.
And this person wants to talk about accents. Lori in Fort Atkinson, who's traveled quite a bit, I've been told that I have an accent. Most are able to even distinguish that I am from Wisconsin. Do you study accents? Have there been questions about accents from reporters?
Well, I don't study it in a formal way, certainly, but it is something I'm paying attention to all the time because it's an important part of our job to help people figure out the right way to pronounce things. So I know there are lots of regional accents. There are people who will train you to lose your regional accent if you so desire. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. I used to have much more of a New York accent, but living in Washington and listening to NPR and being careful about speech, my accent has changed over the years. Primarily, I learned to pronounce the letter R, which we don't use so much in New York. But I have I don't have a great ear, but I can tell the difference between, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina accents and Texas accents or Alabama accents. And I can sort of tell the difference between, you know, the Midwest and the upper Midwest, although I don't think I would be an expert on the difference between Wisconsin and Minnesota, which sound very similar to me. But of course, when you live in a place, you think there's no accent at all.
Right. How true.
It's just the way people talk.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. The president has spent a good portion of the week in India. Page 72 of the book, Why Are Cows Sacred in India?
Ah, okay. Good choice. Why are cows sacred in India? Hindus do not actually worship cattle. It would be more accurate to say that cows are taboo rather than sacred. They are not to be touched. They are agnaya, not to be slaughtered. Cows have been venerated in India since the Vedic era, the second millennium before the current era. They are associated with Mother Earth and the Brahmin class. They symbolize nonviolent generosity, and the products that they give are used in religious rites. Mahatma Gandhi wrote in 1950, "The cause of cow protection is very dear to me. If someone were to ask me what the most important outward manifestation of Hinduism was, I would suggest that it was the idea of cow protection."
Oh, my. Isn't that something? Big thing. Yeah.
Yes.
Scott in La Crosse, our next caller. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, Scott.
You know how you can tell a New Yorker? They
no.
can pronounce Mary, all three Marys with three different pronunciations, what I've heard. What I would like to ask Key is, we have a neighbor state of Minnesota that calls itself Land of 10,000 Lakes, and what I've heard is they've actually got more than 10,000 lakes, and of course, you know, these typical modest northern mm-hmm. Midwesterners. So in her book, and I'm really looking forward to reading it, does she find other facts like this where we think one thing and it's actually totally a lot more impressive?
Well, I didn't count the number of lakes in Minnesota, although I do understand there's lots more than 10,000. But, of course, it's going to depend on, you know, how you define the lake and how tiny some of them might be. But, yeah, I did sometimes put those kinds of facts in the book because I thought people ought to know this. But also sometimes when I started to research a fact, I discovered that what I thought I knew was completely wrong. And an example of that is I wanted to write about the Sahara Desert and how it's the biggest desert and it's advancing and perhaps someday, you know, it will take over most of the continent of Africa. And as I started to look that up, I discovered that was completely wrong. The Sahara is not the largest desert because a desert is not about being hot and sandy. A desert is about lack of precipitation. So the largest desert is actually Antarctica. And I was wrong to think that the Sahara is just continually taking over more and more land because I contacted a professor who helped me understand this, that it's actually advancing and receding, and to think of it more like the ocean, like the waves, the tide coming and going. And in some places, for natural reasons, and other places because people are fighting the advance of the desert by planting trees and being careful about water use. And so it's actually a much more complicated process than I had thought it was.
As they say, who knew, huh?
And as I say, you learn something new every day, and that's why I'm a librarian.
Great. Yes.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, you learn a lot of things. I do, too. Isn't it wonderful to be in this line of work? You learn so much every day. It's wonderful. Yes. Yeah. Thanks, Scott, for the call. Paul in Duluth, Minnesota, the land of 10,000 lakes. Hello, Paul.
Have you counted
and
them?
I live right next door to the biggest of them all. Just a comment about the pronunciation of Missouri. I lived there for a summer without air conditioning, and I call it misery.
Yes.
But my question is, I'm a retired caterer, and I read a lot of books about odd food, and I have a beautiful chow dog, and I read somewhere that whether the in ancient China, whether the animal was used for defense or food depended on the color of its tongue.
Mm. Oh, its tongue. Huh.
Yeah, either chows, full-bred chows typically have a purple tongue, and the others have kind of a pink tongue like most dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never been able to quite figure out the veracity of that.
Hmm. No, I've not heard that story at all. I'm making a note for my next book. I'll have to explain the story of the chow dog.
We're almost out of time, but you must have at least 100 other books right now.
Oh,
don't
sure.
you? Yeah, if not more than that.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Key. It was great fun. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Kathleen.
Key Maleski, the book is All Facts Considered, The Essential Library of Inessential Knowledge. As Scott Simon says, Key is the source of all human knowledge. The book has just been published and is filled with wonderful facts and many, many, many facts, I might add. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, our extraordinary librarian, for producing this program. And thanks to Chrissy Pease, who has a part-time job working at a library as well. So that's what makes this show roll. We'll be with you tomorrow.